It's Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from the golden age of radio. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark Levenier. Settle back for some great mysteries of radio's past. Later on, we'll hear the adventures of Sherlock Holmes with an original Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story. Right now, it's The Fat Man, one of the few surviving broadcasts from this very popular series. Created by Dashiell Hammett, we go back to October 3rd, 1947 on ABC. J. Scott Smart stars in A Window for Murder.
There he goes, into that drugstore. He's stepping on the scales. Weight, 237 pounds. Fortune, danger. Who is it?
The Fat Man. Norwich Pharmacal Company, makers of Pepto-Bismol, Unguentine, and other fine drug products, brings you the adventures of Dashiell Hammett's fascinating and exciting character, the Fat Man, a fast-moving criminologist who tips the scales at 237 pounds. Tonight's adventure, starring J. Scott Smart in A Window for Murder. And now, Pepto-Bismol brings you the Fat Man.
In a lot of ways, crime is like disease. It strikes when you least expect it, and it's no respecter of persons or classes. It spreads in contagious waves, gnawing and digging at the very backbone of society. Medical science has discovered through the years miracle drugs and vaccines that have completely knocked out many of our most dangerous maladies. But the only inoculation against a confirmed criminal is a strong fist and a fast trigger, especially when you're up against a murderer.
How are your eating habits? If you eat too much or too fast, you know how your stomach turns queasy, uneasy, and upset. If that happens, and if you've been overdosing yourself with fizzes or physics, it's time you tried Pepto-Bismol. Now, let's look into A Window for Murder.
My phone rang that morning, and a woman's voice said she was Dr. Eugenia Phelps. Eugenia Phelps. Oh, yes, an old classmate of mine, a mousy, thin, quiet little girl with a razor-sharp brain and no boyfriend. Along with her teaching, she'd studied medicine, won her M.D., become a successful doctor. And she said she was in town now, taking a 3-month refresher course. Having no other friends in the city, she decided to look me up and invited me to dinner. I found her newly settled in Harlequin Court, a 3-room sublet in one of those ancient apartments built around a courtyard. There are lots of them down there in the village. Eugenia had changed considerably. The mousy shyness had given way to a crisp, confident, professional air. The martinis were good, and the dinner was fair. The conversation naturally consisted mostly of, do you remember the time when... And by 10 p.m., I was beginning to stifle yawns and glance furtively at my wristwatch.
Bored, Brad?
Yeah. Oh, no. I was up late last night, though, and I've got a busy day tomorrow.
Well, you've got time for one more drink, haven't you?
Well, it's getting late. I don't know whether I...
Oh, of course you can. One more, for old time's sake. Oh, do you mind making them, Brad?
No, not at all. Here, give me a glass.
Here you are.
In the kitchen back here?
Yes. Straight down the hall. The bottle's on the kitchen table, and you'll find ice cubes in the icebox.
Okay. Oh, by the way, Eugenia, you haven't told me how you like the big city so far.
It's all right, I suppose, but I think I prefer my own little town. I can see why a man like you would like the city, though.
What do you mean?
Like the beautiful girl who's brushing her hair in the apartment across the courtyard out here. She's gorgeous, Brad. You better hurry with those drinks. You're missing something.
Now just tell her to stay put. I'll be right in.
Oh, I've never seen such lovely long red hair.
Oh, a redhead, huh? Why didn't you tell me about her sooner?
Well, I hadn't seen her before. She must have just come in. Oh, she really, it... Brad! Brad, quick!
What's wrong?
That girl. Bill.
What is it, Eugenia? What's the matter? You're shaking like a leaf.
Over there in the apartment across the way.
Well, I can't see anything. The lights are out.
I know, but that girl I was talking about, the one with the long red hair.
What about her?
Somebody just opened the door, stabbed her in the back, and turned off the lights.
You sure it was the apartment directly across from yours?
Yes, positive. Her window was on a direct line with mine.
There's a door over there across the courtyard. That must lead into the girl's side of the house.
Yes.
You didn't see anything with the hand holding the knife?
No. Whoever was holding that knife was hidden by the door.
Could you tell whether it was a man or a woman?
No.
Well, there's nobody here in the hall. Whoever did it must have moved fast to get out through the courtyard before we got down here.
Well, maybe they're still upstairs.
Well, it could be. Come on. Your apartment is up two flights, isn't it?
But yes.
Okay. The girl's apartment must be right at the head of this second flight. That's where your apartment is, on the other side. Come on.
Brad, I...
Are you afraid?
No. No, I'm all right. I'll feel much safer with you.
Okay. This must be the apartment here.
Yes. Girl must be in there alone, Brad.
Yeah, I'll see if this door...
What's wrong?
Somebody's coming to the door. Stand back.
Who are you? What do you want?
A girl was just stabbed in this apartment. Where is she?
A girl? Stabbed? No, no. There's no girl here. There's nobody here but me. Go away! Go away!
Just a minute.
You're trying to trick me. You want to rob me, but I won't let you. I tell you
Who are you, and what are you doing in this apartment?
I'm Enid Judson, of course, and I live in this apartment. I've lived here for years.
Wait, Brad. There must be some mistake, but I'm sure
it's
that...
you. There now, she can tell you I live here. Tell him.
You know her, Eugenia?
No, but I've seen her several times coming in and out. She might live here.
Of course I live here. And now take your foot out of my door or I'll call the police.
If there's going to be any police calling, I'll do it. Now, I'm sorry, Miss Judson, but we're coming in.
Look out, Brad. She's got a knife.
I warned you. I told you to stay out.
Now. You're a little old to start playing with knives, Miss Judson.
Oh, my arm. Don't twist my arm.
I'm sorry, but I'll just have to hold on to this knife.
Well, look, Brad. There's nobody in here.
Yeah, so I see. Okay, Miss Judson, start talking. What happened in here a minute ago, and what happened to the red-headed girl?
I don't know what you're talking about. There wasn't any girl here.
She's crazy, Brad. Must have been she who stabbed the girl.
Crazy, am I? Because I guard what's mine, I'm crazy.
She couldn't have gotten rid of the body in the time it took us to get over here. Where was the girl sitting, Eugenia?
She was sitting over there at the dressing room table, and one by the closet. Brad, that door. That closet door must have been the one I saw open, the one where the hand came out of.
Yeah. I'll have a look inside that closet.
No, don't go in there. Stop! I tell you, stop! Let go of me. Let go of me. Thieves! Thieves!
The girl in there, Brad?
No, she isn't in here. There isn't anything in there at all, except a ball of string as big around as a wagon wheel.
Understand it, Brad. I saw that girl brushing her hair, and then I saw the hand come out of the door holding the knife. I saw it plunge into the girl's back.
You better go on up to your apartment and get a good night's sleep, Eugenia.
But, Brad, I tell you, I saw that girl.
Maybe it was some sort of hallucination. You've been working very hard lately. You said so yourself. People with overstrained nerves sometimes imagine things.
I'm a doctor, Brad. I know about those things, but believe me, this wasn't an hallucination. I saw that girl in the apartment opposite mine, and I saw her stabbed in the back.
But you saw for yourself there wasn't anybody there. The body couldn't have been hidden in the time it took us to cross the courtyard.
I know. I just can't understand it. That Miss Judson is crazy, Brad. It must have been she whose hand I saw.
Well, I'll grant you she acts like a nut, and she had a knife. She might be a killer, too, but as far as I can see... There isn't any proof of it.
I simply don't understand it. Shouldn't we call the police and tell them what I saw?
Well, they'd only laugh at you, Eugenia.
You're laughing at me, too, aren't you? You do think I only imagined it.
I think you've been working too hard. I think you need a good night's sleep.
Brad, you will believe me when the body of that girl I saw murdered tonight is found.
I left Eugenia standing there outside the archway of Harlequin Court, a strained, set expression on her tired, thin face. There was something pitiful about her, and I couldn't help feeling sorry for her. And I had a tough time getting to sleep that night. However, by the next morning, I'd forgotten all about Dr. Eugenia Phelps, Miss Judson, and the night before. At a quarter after 10, the door of my office opened, and a tall, well-dressed woman in her early 30s came in. She wasn't exactly beautiful, and she didn't seem unduly nervous or upset. She walked slowly toward my desk.
Mr. Runyon?
Yes?
I'm Mrs. Ronald Woodruff, and I'd like to hire you.
Oh, what's it all about, Mrs. Woodruff?
First, I must tell you that my home is not in this city. I came here 3 days ago, and I'm staying at the Felton Hotel.
Mm-hmm. What's the job?
It has to do with my husband, Mr. Runyon.
Here we go again.
What?
Skip it, Mrs. Woodruff. What about your husband?
Well, some time ago, 6 months to be exact, he became involved with a beautiful young woman who happened to be working in the town we live in. Well, eventually I discovered his infatuation and confronted them both. I love my husband, and I had no intention of letting him make a fool of himself.
Naturally. What happened?
Well, I won't go into details. Well, the result was that my husband promised not to see this girl again. She, in turn, left our town soon afterwards.
But that didn't fix it?
Well, it seemed to for some months, but several weeks ago, I discovered that they had been corresponding. Once again, I confronted my husband, and once again, he promised to forget the girl. However, a week ago, he suddenly left home and disappeared.
And you think he's come here to join the gang?
I'm positive of it. But so far, I've been unable to find him or prove it. I've seen the woman and talked with her. Well, naturally, she denied that my husband has seen her. She says she's through with him and never wants to see him again.
Oh, you know where this babe lives, then?
Yes, I found her address on the letter I discovered.
Oh, sure.
I want you to watch this woman's apartment house for me. When my husband comes to see her, I want you to find out where he's staying.
Okay. How do I recognize him?
Oh, here's a picture of him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good likeness. I'm sure you can identify him when he comes to see the girl. Here's $100 for expenses. I'll give you $500 more if you'll find him. Will you take the job?
Yeah. What's this woman's name? What does she look like? Where does she live?
Her name is Lenore Longstreet. She lives in a Greenwich Village apartment called Harlequin Court. And she has gorgeous, long, red hair.
The fat man isn't the only one who's got troubles. Here's a poor chap who could be anyone you know, including you.
Francis.
Bill, what are you doing stretched out on the couch? You better get ready if you're going to that meeting.
I'll have to miss it tonight. Too much supper. My stomach's got me down.
Well, don't blame supper. You stuffed yourself like a glutton.
I'm not just stuffed. I feel awful.
I can imagine. You've got a good old-fashioned upset stomach. And I've got just the thing for it. Pepto-Bismol.
And now, let's catch up with the fat man.
A lot of girls have red hair, but not many of them wear it long. There are a lot of courtyard apartments in Greenwich Village, but there's only one called Harlequin Court. A coincidence? Well, maybe. On the way downtown in a cab, I tried to reconstruct what had happened last night after my dinner with Eugenia Phelps. By the time I had it fairly clear in my mind, the cab stopped in front of the apartment house. I paid off the driver and walked through an archway into the courtyard. A row of mailboxes with nameplates above them was neatly arranged on each side of the arch. I stopped and looked at the names on the left side. Dr. Eugenia Phelps was listed there in apartment 2B East. I quickly crossed the archway and looked at the other row of boxes. The first name I saw was Miss Lenore Longstreet. Her apartment was listed as 1B West. Sharp feminine heels clicked along the walk inside the court. I turned and was looking at the startled face of Eugenia Phelps.
Why, Brad.
Good morning, Eugenia.
What on earth are you doing here? You should have called me. I'm just on my way to class.
Well, I didn't come to see you, Eugenia, but I'm glad I ran into you. I've got a hunch you're going to miss your class this morning.
Miss my class? Why?
Somebody hired me a little while ago to keep an eye on a girl who lives here. A girl named Lenore Longstreet. She has beautiful, long, red hair.
You mean that girl? The one I saw last night?
Yeah. I think I owe you an apology. I'm afraid you weren't having hallucinations after all.
But I don't understand.
Well, I think I do now. Come on back here in the courtyard a minute.
What is it, Brad?
Uh-huh. Just as I thought. What a sap I am. I don't know how I could have missed it last night.
Missed what?
Look over here at the door on the right.
Yeah.
Then look on the one on your side. Huh. You notice anything different?
Why?
The steps, sweetheart. The steps. Hmm? When you go in the door on your side, you go down about 5 steps and then start up again to the upper apartments. But on the other side, you do just the opposite. You go up 5 or 6 steps and then start up the regular stairs to the upper apartments.
But I still don't see
what... It's simple. So simple, I missed it last night. The apartment opposite yours is up only one real flight in this building here on the right, while yours is up 2 flights.
Oh, then we went to the wrong apartment.
Sure. That crazy old woman with a ball of string lives in the apartment above the one where you saw the girl stabbed.
How we could have made such a mistake, Brad.
It's the most natural thing in the world. Your apartment is up 2 flights, so anybody would naturally think that the one opposite would be up 2 flights, too.
Then the girl with red hair, the one I saw, she may be lying in there dead.
Well, that's what we're going to find out now. That's the apartment over there.
Look, Brad, the door's slightly open.
Yeah. Whoever wielded that knife last night was really in a hurry.
Is the girl there, Brad?
Yeah, she's here all right. Lying right where you said she ought to be, over by the dressing table. The knife's still in her back.
Oh, Brad.
You better not come in.
You're wrong. I think she had better come in.
Hey,
quick,
what?
Get inside, both of you.
But I...
Quickly! Now, put your hands over your heads, both of you. This gun is loaded, and I'm not afraid to use it.
Ronald Woodruff, isn't it?
What? How did you know my name?
I've got your picture here in my pocket. You like to see it?
You keep your hands where they are. My wife, eh?
You're so right.
So she followed me. She hired you to snoop on me.
Maybe she hired me to keep you from doing just what you did.
What do you mean?
The dead gal over there on the floor.
You're wrong. I didn't kill Lenore. She was dead when I got here a few minutes ago. She's been dead for quite a while. You can see that for yourself. And I didn't kill her, I tell you.
Put that gun away and stop acting like a sap, Woodruff.
Not a chance.
You won't get away. The police will pick you up in no time.
I'm not worried about the police. I'll turn myself in when I've finished what I've got to do.
What do you mean?
I didn't kill Lenore, but I know now who did. And I'm going to take care of it in my own way.
Then he locked you two here in the dead girl's apartment and beat it, huh?
That's right, Mackenzie. By the time I got the door open, he disappeared. So I called you at headquarters.
And you, Dr. Phelps, you say you actually saw this murder happen last night?
Yes. But I didn't see anything but the hand holding the knife. The murderer was hidden behind this door. But I saw the hand plunge the knife into the dead girl's back.
Uh-huh. I still don't see why you didn't report it right away.
Oh, don't be a sap, Mackenzie. I've already told you that we made a mistake in the apartments. The apartment that's 2 flights up in this building is 1 floor above the apartment that is 2 flights up in the other building. We were in a hurry, and it was a perfectly natural mistake to make. When we didn't find a body, I thought that Eugenia here had been imagining things. It wasn't until I came back here this morning that I realized what had happened.
I see. Now, this old lady in the apartment above here, you say she's nuts.
Well, she certainly acts like it. She's an eccentric, to say the least. She's a string saver and guards it with a knife.
Oh, a knife, eh?
She threatened us last night when we tried to get into her apartment. Brad had to take the knife away from her.
Well, maybe she's the one we want. Come on, we'll go up and talk to her.
Now, don't be too sure about this crazy dame, Mackenzie. Woodruff's wife told me that the dead girl had told her she was through with Woodruff. It gives Woodruff a swell motive.
And if she wasn't telling the truth... It gives Woodruff's wife a swell motive.
You're not kidding about that.
We'll pick them both up.
This is the old woman's apartment, right here at the head of the stairs.
Open the door, Miss Judson. Looks like she's going out.
I doubt it. She told us last night that she doesn't leave the apartment very often.
Okay, we'll open it up.
Oh, it's not locked.
Miss Judson. Well, I guess she's not...
Look. They're on the floor behind the bed.
Yeah, it's Miss Judson. Somebody put a knife in her back. Step on it, Mackenzie.
I hope you're right, Brad.
But where are we going, Brad?
To the Felton Hotel. That's where Mrs. Woodruff is registered.
You think she's the killer, huh?
I don't know, but I think her life is in danger.
Her husband?
Yeah.
Why do you suppose old Miss Judson was killed?
Because she knew who the murderer was. Room 715. Here it is, right here.
Who's there?
It's Brad Runyon, Mrs. Woodruff.
You have something to report, Mr. Runyon?
Never mind that. You're okay?
Why, of course. Who are these people? What's wrong?
This is Dr. Eugenia Phelps and Lieutenant Mackenzie of the police.
The police? Why, I don't understand.
Lenore Longstreet was murdered last night.
Oh, did my husband do it?
We thought maybe you could tell us something about it.
But surely you don't think that I...
Your husband was in love with her. That gives you a swell motive.
You haven't heard anything from your husband?
Why, no. Why should I? He doesn't even know I followed him to the city.
Yes, he does. And I think he's checking hotels right now, trying to find you.
But why?
To kill you.
Oh, then he did kill that girl.
He thinks you did. Wait a minute. Now do as I tell you.
All right.
Quick, Mackenzie. You and Eugenia, get out of the line of the door.
Okay.
Now tell him to come in.
Come in? Ronald.
Yes. Yes, it's me. Surprised.
Ronald, what's wrong? Why are you looking at me that way?
She's dead. She's dead, you understand? And you killed her. And now I'm going to...
No, Ronald, no. Put down that gun.
You killed her, and now I'm going to...
Nice shooting, Brad.
Sorry, Woodruff, but I had to stop you from being a murderer. You ought to thank me for that shot.
Well, I don't. I came here to kill my wife because she killed Lenore.
You're wrong, Woodruff. Your wife hasn't killed anybody. Has she, Eugenia?
What? What are you talking about, Brad?
I'm talking about two murders. Two murders that you committed.
You don't know what you're saying.
Way out of your head, Brad. You said yourself she saw the murder across the court. Well, you were there with her.
Yes, I was there with her, all right. But she asked me to go out to the kitchen and mix a drink. Then Eugenia called me and told me she'd seen the stabbing. But the lights were off when I got to the window.
Well, you mean that...
I mean she killed Lenore before I ever got to the apartment last night. I was to be her perfect alibi. She had it all planned to pretend to see the killing.
But why, Brian?
I don't know that yet.
No. No, it's not true. It's not true.
I should have tumbled of the truth last night when I talked to the old woman, but I didn't. It wasn't until just a second ago that it clicked, that I remembered what she said last night.
What?
She recognized Eugenia when we knocked on her door.
Oh, what's that got to do with it?
Plenty. Eugenia made the same mistake about the stairs that I did when she went over to kill Lenore before I arrived last night. Knowing Lenore's apartment was directly across from hers on the same level, without thinking, she went up two flights of stairs and knocked on Miss Judson's door by mistake. That's when the old lady saw her. It was a tough break, wasn't it, Eugenia?
How was that a tough break, Brad?
Well, Eugenia knew that when the body downstairs was discovered, the police would question the old woman. She would remember that Eugenia had knocked on the wrong door, thinking it was the apartment downstairs. So Eugenia figured she had to kill her, too. Right, Eugenia?
Yes. Yes, I killed her. I killed them both. But Lenore deserved to die. She ruined my life, wrecked my career.
How?
She was a nurse for a short time in the hospital at home. One day I was operating and she made a mistake. A bad mistake. It cost the patient's life. It wasn't my fault, but Lenore made it appear that it was. I was dropped from the hospital staff. My reputation, my future, completely ruined.
You could have gone some other place.
Oh, no, Brad. It takes a woman too long to establish herself in the medical profession. So I determined to kill her. She became frightened and ran away. I followed her to the city and searched for her. When I found where she was living, I managed to get the apartment across from hers. Well, you know the rest.
I'm sorry, Eugenia, but nothing justifies murder.
I know. I know. Nothing matters anymore, anyway.
But, Brad, if Eugenia had already made that mistake about the two flights of stairs, why didn't she stop you when you started up the second flight?
Well, I think she did start to, but realized that if she did, I'd know then that she'd been there before. After all, she figured her alibi was already set once it was established that she'd seen the murder while I was in her apartment.
I'll be darned. Clever scheme, all right.
I want to thank you, Runyon, for stopping me a minute ago when I think what I might have done.
Skip it, Woodruff. Take a tip from me. You got a swell wife here, and she loves you. Go on home with her and forget you ever knew a red-headed nurse.
The Fat Man returns in a moment. Have you a bottle of Pepto-Bismol in the house? Next week, Pepto-Bismol presents Dashiell Hammett's exciting character, the Fat Man, in an adventure called Murder Goes Sightseeing. And, as the Fat Man says...
Did you ever go on a sightseeing tour? Lots of fun, isn't it? All kinds of people, all kinds of sights. Some amusing, some colorful, and some of the sights with great historical interest. It's a real adventure. But it's a gruesome adventure when murder goes sightseeing.
Tonight's Adventure of the Fat Man, starring J. Scott Smart, was directed by Clark Andrews. Music is under the direction of Mark Winston. Heard tonight were Alice Frost as Eugenia and Sarah Burton as Mrs. Woodruff. Remember, when your stomach's feeling dismal, take soothing Pepto-Bismol. Charles Irving speaking. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
The Fat Man, on Tuned to Yesterday from October 3rd, 1947 on ABC. Actor J. Scott Smart was at the top of his game during that radio series, though it would be his last regular appointment on radio during its golden era. It's an hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now the adventures of Sherlock Holmes, starring Sir Ralph Richardson and Sir John Gielgud, from March 27, 1955, a syndicated episode based on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's story, The Adventure of Silver Blaze.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, the original and immortal stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized anew with Sir Ralph Richardson as Dr. Watson and Sir John Gielgud in the role of Sherlock Holmes. And now, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, with Sir John Gielgud as Sherlock Holmes and Sir Ralph Richardson as our storyteller, Dr. James Watson.
Many of the cases of Sherlock Holmes were private affairs that made no stir outside the family circles involved. But the disappearance of Silver Blaze was a matter which set the whole country by the ears. For not merely had this horse, the favorite for the Wessex Cup, vanished for a week before the great race, but his trainer had also been tragically murdered. John Straker, the trainer, lived in a small villa about 200 yards from the stable.
I see you have some newspapers there, Watson. Let's see what they have to say about the matter.
Oh, well, here's the Morning Post. It says, the horses had been exercised and watered as usual, and the stables locked up at 9 o'clock. Two of the lads walked up to the trainer's house, where they had supper in the kitchen, whilst a third, Ned Hunter, remained on guard. A few minutes after nine, the maid, Edith Baxter, carried his supper, a dish of curried mutton, down to the stables. As the path ran over the open moor, she carried a lantern with her. About 30 yards away from the stables, a man appeared out of the darkness and called to her to stop.
Excuse me, miss. Oh! Can you tell me where I am? I'd almost made up my mind to sleep on the moor when I saw your lantern.
You're close to King's Pile in training stable, sir.
I am. What a stroke of luck. I understand that the stable boy sleeps there alone every night. Perhaps that's his supper you're carrying.
Yes, sir. But it'll be getting cold.
Yes, but you wouldn't be too proud to earn the price of a new dress now, would you? See, the boy gets this note tonight, and you have the prettiest dress that money can buy.
Let me pass, sir. I'm not giving notes to anybody.
The girl was frightened by his manner, and she ran past him to the stable window hatch, through which she always used to hand the boy his meals. The hatch was already open, and the boy was waiting inside. She'd just begun to tell him what had happened when the stranger came up again.
Good evening. I wanted to have a word with you.
What business have you here?
Business that may put something in your pocket. You've two horses in for the Wessex Cup, Silver Blaze and Bayard. Let me have the straight tip and you won't be the loser. Is it a fact that at the weights, Bayard could give the other 100 yards?
So you're one of them damn touts? Well, I'll show you how we serve them at King's Pyland. Just wait till I set the dog free. Rover! Rover!
The boy ran to unleash the dog, and the maid hurried towards the house. But looking back, she saw the stranger leaning in through the stable window. A minute later, when Hunter rushed out with the dog, the stranger was gone. Yes, that's as far as we can get with the Morning Post, I'm afraid. Mrs. Hudson very stupidly used the other half of the paper to light the fire this morning. Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, no matter, my dear fellow. The Telegraph has also covered the occurrence very fully. I have it here. Hunter, on the return of his fellow grooms, sent a message up to the trainer, Straker, to tell him what had happened. Straker seems to have been vaguely uneasy about the matter, for although he'd been to bed, he got up again at 1 o'clock in the morning, telling his wife that he was going down to the stable to see if all was well. He put on a mackintosh, for it was raining heavily, and left the house. Quite a wealth of detail, my dear Watson. And here I have the notes of Mrs. Straker's statement. After her husband had gone out, she went back to sleep again and didn't wake until 7 o'clock in the morning. Finding him still absent, she called the maid and they set off together for the stables. They found the door wide open. Inside, huddled on a chair, was Hunter in a state of complete stupor. The lads in the loft overhead had heard nothing all night, but the favorite stall was empty and there was no sign of the trainer.
Hunter had obviously been drugged.
Undoubtedly. Mrs. Straker and the maid left him and ran up to the moor to see whether Straker had merely taken the horse out for exercise, and so the murder was discovered. Suppose you read me the rest of Mrs. Straker's statement.
Oh, well, yes, here it is. Well, some quarter of a mile from the stables, Mrs. Straker and the maid found Straker's coat flapping from a furze bush. Immediately beyond, there was a bowl-shaped depression on the moor, and at the bottom of this, John Straker's body was found. His head shattered by a savage blow from some heavy weapon, wounded in the thigh, a long, clean cut, evidently inflicted by some sharp instrument. Straker had obviously tried to defend himself, for in his left hand, he grasped a red and black silk cravat, which was recognized by the maid as having been worn by the stranger who'd spoken to her outside the stables. Hunter, the stable boy, also identified it when he'd recovered from the effects of the drug. This was apparently powdered opium, which had been put into his curried mutton. Now, that explains what the stranger was doing as he leant through the stable window. Mm-hmm. For the lads who ate the same meal at the trainer's house were quite all right, so only one plate had been drugged. It goes on to say there were abundant proofs in the mud which lay at the bottom of the fatal hollow that the missing horse, Silver Blaze, had been there at the time of the struggle.
Well, Watson, that has passed our little journey quite agreeably. And here we are at Tavistock.
Tavistock lies like the boss of a shield in the middle of the huge circle of Dartmoor. Two gentlemen were waiting for us at the station, Silver Blaze's owner, the well-known sportsman Colonel Ross, and Inspector Gregory of Scotland Yard.
I'm delighted that you've come down, Mr. Holmes. The inspector here has done all that could possibly be suggested, but I wish to leave no stone unturned in trying to avenge poor Straker and recover my horse.
I trust that I may be able to assist you, sir. Has there been any fresh development?
I'm sorry to say we've made very little progress. As you know, we've had no difficulty in tracing the stranger,
He was well known in the neighborhood. His name is Fitzroy Simpson, man who's come down in the world and lives by a little quiet and genteel bookmaking in the London clubs. His books show that he was carrying bets up to £5,000 against the favorite. When confronted with the cravat, he turned very pale and was utterly unable to account for its presence in the hand of the murdered man.
Of course, Straker himself was wounded, wasn't he? In the thigh. He may have wounded himself in the convulsive struggles which follow any brain injury.
Excellent, my dear Watson. It's more than possible. It's probable. In which case, one of the main points in favor of the accused disappears.
A minute later, we were all seated in a comfortable landau and were rolling through the quaint old Devonshire town.
A clever counsel would tear your case to rags. Why should Simpson take the horse out of the stable? If he wished to injure it, he could do it there. Has a duplicate key to the stable door been found in his possession? What chemist sold him the powdered opium? Above all, where could he, a stranger to the district, hide a horse? And such a horse as this? Tell me, what is his own explanation as to the note which he wished the maid to give to the stable boy?
He says it was a £10 note, and one was found in his purse. Also, he's not a stranger to the district. He's twice lodged at Tavistock in the summer. The opium he probably brought with him from London. The key, having served its term, will be hurled away. As for the horse, it may well lie at the bottom of one of the pits or old mines upon the moor.
What does he say about the cravat?
He admits that it's his and says that he lost it. But a new element has been introduced into the case, which may account for his leading the horse from the stables. We found traces that show that a party of gypsies encamped on Monday night within a mile of the spot where the murder took place. On Tuesday, they were gone. Simpson may well have been leading the horse to them when he was overtaken.
It's certainly possible.
The moor has been scoured for them. Meanwhile, I've examined every stable and outhouse in Tavistock and for a radius of 10 miles.
There's another training stable quite close, I believe.
Yes, and that's a factor we must certainly not neglect. As Desborough, their horse, was second in the betting, they had an interest in the disappearance of Silver Blaze. Silas Brown, their trainer, is known to have had large bets upon the event, and he was no friend to poor Straker. However, we've examined his stables, and there's nothing to connect him with the affair.
And nothing to connect Fitzroy Simpson with their interests?
Nothing at all. Ah, well, here we are.
Our driver had pulled up at a little red brick villa which stood by the road. Colonel Ross asked Holmes whether he would like to go on to the scene of the crime.
No, I think I prefer to stay here a little while and go into one or two questions of detail. Straker was brought back here, I suppose.
Yes, he lies upstairs. The inquest is tomorrow.
He's been in your service some years, Colonel.
I've always found him an excellent servant.
I presume that you made an inventory of what he had in his pockets at the time of his death, Inspector.
I have the things themselves here in the sitting room.
Here they are. A box of matches, 2 inches of tallow candle, pencil case, a few papers, and the ivory-handled knife.
Yeah, very singular knife, Watson. Surely in your line.
It's what we call a cataract knife. We use it for surgical purposes, including very delicate operations.
A strange thing for a man to carry with him on a rough expedition. Why, it won't even shut up to go into his pocket.
The tip was guarded by a cork, which we found beside his body. His wife tells us that he kept it for some days on the dressing table and picked it up as he left the room. A poor weapon, but perhaps the best he could lay his hands on at the moment.
And the papers?
Hay dealer's accounts. This letter from Colonel Ross and this dressmaker's account for £37.15 made out by Madame Lejeune of Bond Street.
May I see that bill, please?
Certainly. It's made out to William Derbyshire.
William Derbyshire?
Mrs. Straker tells us he was a friend of her husband's and that occasionally letters for him were addressed here.
Had he been staying here then? Did Mrs. Straker know him?
I gather not, but here is Mrs. Straker. Mr. Sherlock Holmes, Mrs. Straker.
How do you do, sir?
How do you do, Mrs. Straker? Surely we've met before at a garden party in Plymouth recently.
No, sir, you must be mistaken.
Dear me, I could have sworn it. You wore a costume of dove-coloured silk with ostrich feather trimmings.
Never had such a dress, sir.
Well, that settles it, then.
If you'll excuse me, sir, I'd like a word with the Colonel.
Of course.
I'll be with you in a moment, Mr. Holmes. Inspector.
Holmes, I believe you got your hand on a clue.
Oh, do you? As a matter of fact, I was just remembering a really excellent curry we once ate together in Soho.
Sherlock Holmes next asked to be shown the spot where the murder had been committed. A short walk across the moor brought us to the hollow in which the body had been found. At the brink of it was the furze bush upon which the Mackintosh belonging to the murdered man had been hung.
There was no wind that night, I understand.
None, but very heavy rain.
Well, in that case, the coat was not blown against the furze bushes. It must have been placed there.
Yes, it was laid across the bush.
Very interesting.
In this bag, I have one of the boots which Straker wore, one of Fitzroy Simpson's shoes, and a cast horseshoe of silver blaze.
My dear Inspector, you surpass yourself.
Holmes took the bag, and descending into the hollow, he made a careful study of the trampled mud in front of him.
Hello. What's this? A spent match, eh? Excellent.
I can't think how I came to miss it.
It was invisible, buried in the mud. I only found it because I was looking for it.
What? You expected to find it?
I thought it not unlikely. You'll have searched the ferns round the rim of the hollow for any more tracks, of course.
I'm afraid there are none. I've examined the ground very carefully for 100 yards in each direction.
Good. Then I'll take a little walk over the moors before it grows dark. And I think I'll put this horseshoe in my pocket, just for luck.
I suppose you know your own methods best, Mr. Holmes. Perhaps you'll come back with me, Inspector. There are several matters on which I need your advice. Especially as to whether we owe it to the public to scratch Silver Blaze from the Wessex Cup.
Certainly not, Colonel. I should let the name stand.
I am very glad to have your opinion, sir. We shall see you later on, when you've finished your walk.
Colonel Ross and the inspector went back to the villa, whilst Holmes and I walked slowly across the moor.
We may leave the question of who killed John Straker for the moment and confine ourselves to finding out what has become of the horse. Now, supposing he broke away during or after the tragedy, where could he have got to?
Almost anywhere on Dartmoor, I should imagine.
Oh, dear, no. The horse is a gregarious animal. If left to himself, his instincts would have been either to return to King's Pyland or go on over to Capleton yonder. Why should he run wild upon the moor? As he's not at King's Pyland, he must be over there at Capleton. Come along.
We've not far to go. And as we approached the gates of Capleton, we met a groom coming out of them.
We don't want any loiterers round here.
I only wanted to ask you a question. Would I be too early to see your master, Mr. Silas Brown, if I were to call here at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning?
Why, bless you, sir. If anyone's about, it'll be him. He's always the first stirring.
Watch this, Dawson. No gossiping. Go on about your business. And you there. What the devil do you want here?
10 minutes talk with you, my good sir.
Well, I've no time to talk to every gadabout. And we don't want strangers here. Be off, or you may find a dog at your heels.
One word in your ear, my friend. In your own interest.
It's a lie. An infernal lie.
Very good. Shall we argue about it here in public, or talk it over in your parlor? Or do I go to the police?
It was 20 minutes before he returned.
It shall be done, sir, just as you wish it.
There must be no mistake.
Oh, no, there shall be no mistake. It shall be there. Should I change it first or not?
No, don't. I'll write to you about that. No tricks now.
Oh, no, you can trust me. You can trust me.
Yes, I think I can. Well, you shall hear from me tomorrow. Good day to you.
Good day, sir.
You see, Watson, a more perfect compound of the bully, coward, and sneak than Master Silas Brown I've seldom met with.
He has the horse, then?
Oh, he tried to bluster it out. But I told him so exactly what his actions had been that morning that he's convinced I was actually watching him. He was first down, as usual, and seeing a strange horse wandering on the moor, he went out to it. When he recognized it as Silver Blaze, from the white splash on its forehead, his first instinct was to return it to the King's Pyland stable, which he set out to do. But then he realized that if the horse could only be hidden till after the Wessex Cup, his own horse, Desborough, would almost certainly win. So he changed his mind and turned back halfway, brought Silver Blaze down to his own stables.
But I thought his stables had been thoroughly searched.
Oh, an old horse faker like him has many a dodge.
Ah, but aren't you afraid to leave the horse in his power now, since he's every interest in injuring it?
My dear fellow, he'll guard it like the apple of his eye. He knows that his only hope of mercy is to produce it safely at the racetrack for the Wessex Cup. But I have a little trick to play on Colonel Ross. You may have noticed that his manner to me was just a trifle cavalier. So neither of us, please, for the present, will say anything to him about the horse.
Well, certainly not, if you wish it.
And of course, this is all quite a minor matter compared with the question of who killed John Straker.
And you'll devote yourself to that in the meantime.
On the contrary, we'll both go back to London by the night train.
I was thunderstruck by my friend's words. We'd only been a few hours in Devonshire. That he should give up an investigation in which he had begun so brilliantly was quite incomprehensible to me. Not one word more could I draw from him until we were back at the trainer's house, where the colonel and the inspector were waiting for us.
My friend and I returned to town by the midnight express. We've had a charming little breath of your Dartmoor air.
So you despair of arresting the murderer of poor Straker?
There are certainly grave difficulties in the way. I have every hope, however, that your horse will be at the racetrack next Tuesday, and I beg that you'll have your jockey in readiness. Oh, may I take this photograph of John Straker with me back to town?
Well, Inspector, I'm rather disappointed in our London consultant. I don't see that we're any further than when he came.
At least you have his assurance that your horse will run next week.
Yes, I have his assurance. I should prefer to have my horse.
We went outside.
Goodbye, Colonel. I hope to see you at the Wessex Cup and Silver Blaze.
4 days later, Holmes and I saw Silver Blaze win the Wessex Cup by a good 6 lengths. But it was not a Silver Blaze that even its owner could recognize. There was no trace to be seen of the famous white splash on its forehead or of the mottled off foreleg. The Silver Blaze that won the Wessex Cup was a powerful bay. It was only in the weighing enclosure after the race that Holmes began to explain to a colonel who was completely bewildered.
You rode it to wash his face and his leg in spirits of wine, and you'll find that he's just the same old Silver Blaze as ever.
You take my breath away.
As I found him in the hands of a faker and took the liberty of running him just as he was sent over.
My dear sir, you've done wonders. I owe you 1,000 apologies. You've done me a very great service by recovering my horse. You would do me a greater still if you could lay your hands on the murderer of John Straker.
I've done so.
You've done so?
You've got him.
But where is he then?
What?
He's in our company at the present moment.
That is either a very bad joke, Mr. Holmes, or is it an insult?
I'm not referring to you, Colonel. The real murderer is standing immediately before you.
The horse?
Yeah, the horse. Silver Blaze himself. It may lessen the guilt somewhat if I say that the killing was done entirely in self-defense, and that John Straker was a man who was quite unworthy of your confidence. There goes the bell, and as I stand to win a little on the next race, I shall defer a lengthier explanation till a more fitting time.
It was not until we were on our way back to London that Holmes would get down to these explanations, despite the impatience of both the Colonel and myself.
I must confess that I even suspected Fitzroy Simpson myself for a time. It was only when I reached the trainer's house that the immense significance of the curried mutton occurred to me.
The curried mutton? You mean when you mentioned our Soho meal?
Exactly. Powdered opium has a disagreeable and perceptible flavor. Only something more strongly flavored, like a curry, could have disguised the taste. Now, Fitzroy Simpson could never have known that the maid would be serving the stable lad with a curry that night. The only people who could have known that were people in the house. So who could have taken advantage of the fact? Then there was the silence of the dog when the horse was taken from the stable. It failed to bark because it knew who the intruder was. I was already quite convinced that the intruder must have been John Straker himself.
John Straker himself?
Why did he wish to take Silver Blaze out onto the moor in the dead of night and secretly?
The answer to that was in John Straker's pocket.
The dressmaker's bill?
Precisely. Addressed to William Derbyshire. That set me thinking. Perhaps John Straker was leading a double life. After all, his wife confirmed that the expensive costume wasn't for her. And by recognizing the photo that I showed her, Madame Lesurier, the dressmaker, later confirmed that John Straker had indeed bought it there to give to a woman of more expensive tastes than his wife.
In fact, John Straker was leading a double life and was in bad financial straits.
John Straker. I can scarcely believe it.
The knife gave me the final clue. It was a surgical knife, such as could be used to lame a horse without leaving any visible evidence of foul play. By laming Silver Blaze and betting on Desborough, John Straker would have been able to retrieve his fortune.
The scoundrel, the man I trusted.
He led the horse out onto the moor, so that when he cut its tendon, its plunging wouldn't waken the grooms overhead. In order that he could see what he was going to do, he needed a candle. So that the candle should not be seen, he led the horse to the hollow. In lighting the candle, he dropped that spent match in the mud. Unfortunately for him, the light must have scared the horse, unless it was instinct. Whichever it was, the horse lashed out and its steel shoe caught Straker full in the forehead. He'd already taken off his mackintosh to be freer, and as he fell, gashed his thigh on his own knife.
But my dear fellow, you might have been there. Wonderful.
And the cravat, Fitzroy Simpson's, which was in the dead man's hand.
Simpson said that he lost it. No doubt he did. Straker must have found it and picked it up, perhaps with the idea of using it to secure the horse's leg. Well, that disposes of everything. Quite simple. Perhaps we could while away the rest of this journey, my dear Watson, with a game of chess.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, based on the original stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, have been dramatized anew with original music composed by Sidney Torch.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes on Tuned to Yesterday from March 27th, 1955. That brings to an end this hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levillier. Thanks for tuning in.